However, after the first day or so, I was in heaven. I had all that I wanted for the first time in my life. I never would want, you know. I would say, listen, you got something? And he would say, sure, baby. And there I would go. And I was told he had the finest booze. That I never knew the difference between wine and whiskey. If it had alcohol in it, I wanted it. I liked the taste of it. Whatever it was, I liked it. I liked the way it felt. I never knew the difference. You know, I know good wine. I know fine scotch. I don't know any of that stuff. But if it gets me loaded, I like it. I like it. Always liked it. I remember when I was a kid, I must have been about 6 or 7 years old. Somehow I remember a party, a group of people, and there were these kegs of beer. I'm digressing. The beer looked good and it smelled good to me. And I reached out and had a glass of beer. And before I finished the glass, I reached out for another glass. I never had one beer ever in my life. That I tasted. I love the taste of beer. I love the taste of beer. From 6 years old to this very minute, I love the taste of beer. However, I just don't drink beer. So let me get back to the story. So here I am in Sing Sing prison, getting really ripped and building up a tremendous capacity for heroin. Tremendous. China White. That's the type of heroin that was used in New York at that time. Beautiful China White. Yeah. You get it, right? And after about 6 months, I was called into the assistant warden's office, who said, you know, we made a mistake. The state of New York apologizes for the mistake, and we will give you clean clothes and money to get you back to where we picked you up. And they gave me some clothing, of course, pre-used clothing that was washed, and enough money to get back to Brooklyn. And I landed in Brooklyn with no money and a $150 day habit and no way to get it. However, I had gained weight by that time. I was healthy. I was feeling good. And so I started to steal my money again. However, I wasn't a cute little kid anymore. People were putting up a fight now. I was big, too big to be missed. So people were fighting back. I was not getting what I needed. I could not get enough booze. I could not get enough dope. I could not get enough anything. I was living in these burned out buildings in Brooklyn, having a hell of a time. I remember a time I was sitting in the winter in this building with no windows or any of that, with, you know, those t-shirts that like straps around, they don't have sleeves. You know those undershirts that men wear? Wife beaters. Yeah. You said it, I didn't. I was wearing that shirt with some old holy pants on, sitting on a slab of concrete with a needle in my arm, thinking, and I remember the feeling, man, this is cool. This is great. And I just didn't realize where I was at. I didn't realize what was going on. I didn't realize that as soon as this shot was done, I'd be out looking for another one and having to really work for it and maybe not getting it and maybe getting sick. And by this time, I wasn't getting loaded anymore. I was just protecting myself from getting sick. And I was getting sick. And I, in those days, nothing was sterilized. Nothing was new. So I had infections everywhere. All the kinds of things that you hear about what happened to junkies. My teeth were falling out. And I was getting sicker and sicker and didn't know what to do, because as I was getting sicker, I was getting weaker, and as I was getting weaker, I was less able to get money. And when I was less able to get money, I was less able to get myself well again. And finally, on February 15th, 1954, I woke up between two piles of snow, facing curbstone. In New York City, when it snows, they have these snow plows come down the street and push the snow on the side, and you get these great big hills of snow. And I was in between two of these hills of snow, looking at the curbstone, and water was trickling down right near my nose. And I looked up over the curbstone, as cold as I was, and smelled coffee. And I knew that if I smelled coffee, there were some people there. And if there was people there, I could talk my way into some of that coffee, and talk my way into some money, and get myself well again, and start the thing rolling. And as I looked over the curbstone, I saw this storefront. An empty store, and in New York in those days when the store was empty, they smoked the windows. They put something on the windows that you could see the light through the window, but you couldn't see anything in it. And so it was one of those things, and the coffee was coming from there, and I figured, well, there they are. Here I am. So I walked in the room. There were a few guys sitting around a table, all men. I knew I can get whatever I wanted to. All men sitting alone, talking low. And over to the left, there was this table. And on the table, there was this big aluminum percolator with steaming coffee in it. And right next to it, there were these large rows, long rows of sugar donuts. Chock full of nuts sugar donuts. Best donuts in the world. They don't make them anymore. Wish they did. And I walked over to the table and took a cup, poured the coffee, just drank it, poured the coffee, and started eating the donuts. And just kept doing this stuff. And you know, like I was, you know, like feeding a habit, just doing it, and forgetting my surroundings. You know, when you're fixing, you're getting fixed. You know, I was getting fixed. I was feeling okay. And all of a sudden, I felt a heavy hand on my shoulder and turned around and saw this guy that looked like a farmer with his hair slicked down with some stuff hanging up like this. He was wearing a nondescript color jacket with a red flannel shirt on, with a tie, with brownish, blackish, grayish pants, brown shoes, and white socks. And he looked at me, and he said, "You an alcoholic?" I said, "Well, I'm from New Jersey, and I need to get to New Jersey. My parents and I were here, and I lost them. I need $5 to get through the tubes to get to my house in Jersey. If you give me the $5, my father will drive us back, and he'll give you $10. Now, that's a good deal, isn't it?" He said, "Are you an alcoholic?" And I said, "All I need is $5, and all these other three or four guys around the table were looking at me and looking at each other and going, So the guy said to me, do you want to get sober? I said, sure. I didn't know what that meant. For $5, I'll do anything. So he said, why don't you come up to my apartment and we'll talk about it. I figured, here we go, I'm going to get $50 now. So we went up to his apartment, which was two flights up, and I started to shake. I was sick. I was hungry, which means I hadn't eaten in days, which means I haven't had any dope for days. And so I started to get sick, really sick. Well, this man turned out to... this was an AA meeting that I happened into, by the way. This man jumped on me and stayed on my chest for about a month until I stopped kicking. And he fed me every day. And he said, look, if you want to stay here, you can stay here. I'll keep you here for a year. The only thing you have to do is not be out of my sight for the whole year. And, you know, I was not that sick anymore, but he was feeding me food. He wasn't hitting me, which is the first time in my life I knew somebody who didn't hit me. Everybody that I knew beat me or did something terrible to me. He didn't do any of that stuff. He just did stupid things like he would read a book to me every day, take me downstairs to a meeting three times a day and watch these people. And the funny thing is, he kept telling me, shut up, don't say anything. And every morning, he would read this to me. My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all of my affairs. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead, he said. And how appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again. And if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it's just like that. So he read that to me every day. And when I was able to see, which was a couple of months down the road, I'd read it back to him, and he'd read it to me, and we'd read the rest of this book. I didn't know what the hell this was about. And we'd go down to these meetings, and the guys would talk and look at this book, and I had no idea what was going on. But I was getting meals every day. All I had to do was keep the bathroom door open so he could watch me. I couldn't go anywhere without him watching me. He wouldn't go anywhere without taking me. But it was cool. I was getting fed. I wasn't getting beat. I was warm every day. My clothing was clean because I would wash all the clothes. I'd sweep up the place. I'd wash the dishes. But it was easy. Nobody was hitting me. And then it came to February 15, 1955, a year later. And he said, well, your year is over. You can stay here or you can leave, depending on whatever you want to do. However, I'm going to go for a walk. Finally, he was free. And finally, I knew where he kept his rent money. And so as he left, I went to the place where he put his rent money. And I knew where I was going. You know where I was going. I went, now you got to picture this. I went out of the house. It was on Myrtle Avenue in Brooklyn. And the dealer was around the block on that side. So I went around the block and turned the corner, noticing that he did the same thing. As I was walking and he was walking. I was going to the dope dealer and he was going to me. And as he got closer, I started to sweat because I had his rent money in my pocket. And I was about to steal his rent money, the guy who saved my ass for a year, guy who fed me for nothing, who didn't beat me or say anything bad to me. I had his rent money, and I was going to get loaded with his rent money. And as he got closer, I started to sweat more. And it seemed like we were walking for hours, you know, like a movie thing. And it was really like that, because I was afraid, because I knew what would, I knew what was coming. And he was tall and thin, but he was wiry, and he was going to kick my ass. And we walked and walked, and he started looking at me in my face. And as we got within arm's distance, he looked at me in the face and said, "Don't be stupid. Let's go home, boy." Then I understood what he was talking about. Then I understood what that paragraph was about. I understood what service was about. I understood that AA meant something to me. I understood that what these guys sitting around the table talking about was saving my life. And this man was Robert Johnson. He was my sponsor. He remained my sponsor until he died. We never argued because he was always right. He made me promise certain things, that I would get a job and never stop working. I would go to school and never stop learning. I would get involved in sports and martial arts. And two things he whispered to me: never pray in a crowd and never memorize anything in the big book. Those are the rules. He wasn't the kind of guy that you would ask why. You just did what he said. So to this day, that thing that I read to you from the big book, I have read every day for 51 years. I still haven't memorized it. And I still don't pray in a crowd. Robert Johnson got sober in Akron, Ohio. His sponsor was Dr. Bob. He was a hobo. He rode the rails in those days, lived in the hobo jungles, and he saved my life. And he saved the lives of many, many people, because in that house, there was the meeting room on the main floor. The second floor was a big room where people would go to dry out, and on the top floor was where he lived with me. Talk about miracles, huh? Talk about the spirit of AA. Talk about the strength of a sponsor, the bond between the sponsor and the sponsee. Whatever he says is right. If you have a sponsor, don't forget who runs AA. The one who runs AA picked your sponsor for you. There is no firing the sponsor. Whatever the sponsor says is right, because the one who runs AA runs your sponsor. So Mr. Johnson told me, he didn't tell me that, he showed me that. He showed me that service has to do with how you live inside, not what you necessarily do outside. The outside stuff is just following what you live on the inside. And, well, he died. In the length of my sobriety, I have had three sponsors. My most recent sponsor died this year. Father Charlie Murphy, he died. I think I found another sponsor. We're checking each other out now.
For him, it's a death sentence.
What was that?
For him, it's a death sentence.
He doesn't know whether he can handle my crazy alcoholic self. And what has transpired since then is that I have continued to work every day, continue to go to meetings every day, continue to speak to my sponsor as often as possible, deal with people, serve everyone, feed everyone, remember who God is and my relationship to God, and keep learning. I've gone to lots and lots of schools, I have degrees, all because he said that I had to do that. I was born with a minimal brain damage, so that learning for me is not easy, but he told me I got to do it. And so I do it. Can I have a water, please? AA was the beginning of my life at 16 years old. Before that, I was involved in massive abuse, given and received, extremely addicted stuff. I don't use drugs or alcohol anymore, but I'm still an alcoholic. I have to watch myself. I have to check out what I'm not sure about. When I feel uncomfortable about anything that I have to do, I don't take responsibility for it anymore. You know, it's not my business. If I have to do it, I'll do it, and understand that there's somebody else who's making these decisions for me. The third step works. It works for you. The third step is here, and it works for you. It works for everybody. If you understand that the result of your behavior is none of your business, the work that you're doing is God's work, whatever it is. You could very easily see what God's will is. It's so easy, it's right in front of you. Whatever just happened is God's will. Whatever just happened, anything that happens is God's will. Forgetting passports, having diarrhea attacks. You should have seen my room yesterday. There are certain things that I really have to say even though I don't like to. And I had to clean. I had to clean up something besides the room. I called up room service and I said, "Yes." They said, "Yes." I said, "One of the kids had an accident in my bathroom." lie. And when the lady came up, I said to her, "It really was me." My friend John Paul was there while all this was going on, and he left really quick. So here I am. I'm 68 years old and 51 years sober. I don't have to like any one of you people. I don't have to like you at all. I have to love you. I have to love you or I'll die. I have to listen to you or I'll die. I have to watch carefully and make sure that you don't fall down, because I love you so much, if you fall, I'll die. You are. Lives as you. God also lives inside me as me. Thank you. My name is Marty Malas. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Marty. We love you, Marty. Lots and lots and lots. Oh.
We don't do that. It's so cool. You're so beautiful, man. Am I talking not well?
No, you're talking fine.
Okay. I was assigned as the spiritual speaker, and I don't know what that is. I called my son this morning because he's a very spiritual guy, and I said, Matt, they asked me to be a spiritual speaker, and I don't know what the fuck that is. So, tell me something spiritual. What should I tell him? He said, just tell him you're just the next guy. And that's what I am. I'm just the next guy, a spiritual, whatever that is. I will be whatever I am. I'll start with a very surprising incident that occurred as I was coming out here, and it'll take form later on. I was visiting my wife's parents for Christmas and went from San Antonio, Texas to Phoenix, Arizona to Vancouver to get here. And I forgot to bring my passport. So when I got on the plane from Phoenix to Vancouver, the lady at the desk said, I went there to see if I could get a first-class ticket. Do you have any first-class tickets? Because you guys paid for my tickets, so I figured I could pay for the first class, you know, fill it up a little. And she said, no, but do you have your passport? And I said, no. She said, you know that Vancouver is a foreign country. And I didn't realize that. I didn't realize, you know, Canada and America are like right across the street. So I didn't know what to do, and so I said, listen, I don't know what to do. And she said, well, I don't know what to do either, but I'll let you get there. I don't know if they'll let you stay there. So I went on the plane and got really nervous. I was very, very nervous, you know, like 51 years of sobriety and forgot my passport, right? I didn't want to look bad, right? A 51-year-old, 68-year-old asshole. So I was nervous and nervous and nervous until about three-quarters of the way through the trip, I realized that I'm an alcoholic and that I don't, you know, God's will is just knowing that there's God's will. That's what God's will is. If I know that there's God's will, then I'm cool. So I sat back in my third class seat and thought in my mind, okay, Jack, it's yours. Do whatever you want. Take it. It's yours. I'm not responsible. I did what I could. Now it's up to you, and forget about it. Well, I remained a little bit nervous, but I was cool. I got off the plane, and I had to go through the immigration part, and as I got closer, I started getting nervous again. I couldn't hold on to that third step, you know, I just couldn't hold on to it. And finally, it came to me, and I walked up and gave him my driver's license. You know, here's my driver's license. And he said, well, where's your passport? And I said, I don't have one. He said, what do you mean you don't have one? I said, I left it home in Los Angeles. He said, don't you know you're in a foreign country? And I said, yeah, but I forgot my passport. And he looked at my form and he said, well, you're only going to be here for 2 days. What are you going to be doing in 2 days? And I said, I'm going to be speaking at this young person's convention. He said, oh, the AA convention? I said, yeah. He said, okay, boom, boom, go ahead. That's the part of my pitch that I can guarantee you is the truth. Now, my story starts when I was born. Because when I was born, I met the person for the first time who was my opium connection, because I was born addicted to heroin. My mother was a wild junkie. My father was an alcoholic. And they put each other down, you know. At least I don't drink, my mother would say to him. And he would say, shut up, you stupid junkie. But I was addicted to heroin. I was born addicted to heroin. And in 1937, at the Brooklyn Women's Hospital, they had no idea that there were addicted babies in the world. They just didn't know what to do with me. They couldn't control me. They couldn't control my seizures that I was told that I had as a newborn. Couldn't control anything. And so they kept me in the hospital for a long, long time until they found how to control me. And how they controlled me was with a drug called Paregoric, which is an old way of doing opium. And they controlled me beautifully. They gave me opium, and I was cool. The baby was finally cool. He shut up, and he went to sleep. When I was discharged from the hospital, from what I understand, they gave my parents a large supply of medicine for me so that I wouldn't keep them up at night. And so they continued to feed me Paragon. And from what I understand, they kept getting refills on that prescription for a long, long time. A long, long time. In those days, drugs were drugs, and they were all over the place. It was very easy for a physician to order anything in America. And when we finished the Paragoric, which was, I had to be a year or a year and a half old, I got crazy again. And they couldn't control me again. And they didn't know what to do. When my mother wasn't nodding, she was being bombarded with a crazy little kid who wouldn't stop screaming. And my father devised a method to keep me quiet. And what he did was put a little alcohol in my bottle. And so I stayed stoned through my entire toddlerhood, and was this when I was walking around, when I was able to walk around, I was that cute little kid who would drink the beer that was left over. And so I stayed drunk. I just stayed drunk. I stayed loaded. I was able to watch my mother shoot up every day. She was my hero. I noticed that she was able to be comfortable that way. And when she wasn't shooting up and nodding and drooling on her chest, she wasn't comfortable anymore. So I just continued to be at home with the father who was completely out of his mind, walking around. There was rye whiskey. There was a brand called Carstairs. Remember that? Remember Carstairs? It had this long bottle, this long neck bottle, brown bottle. And my father would stagger around the house with this long neck bottle. I don't remember him without a bottle. I've never seen him without a bottle in my life. So he was tripping all over himself with the bottle. My mother was drooling on her chest. And I was cool. I was loaded most of the time, mostly every day, straight through my life. And when I was about 11, I was so curious about what was going on, I actually got into my mother's stash and knew just how to do it. And I took my first shot of dope when I was 11. I hit it the first time, for anybody who knows about it, I hit it right the first time. And it was just bizarre. It was wonderful. I never met an opiate that I didn't like. And it started off great. I liked every part of it. I liked the constipation that came with it. I liked the puking that sometimes went right alongside the first shot in the morning. And when I was 12, by the way, how long am I going to be talking here? Forever?
No.
Oh, okay. I've been alive for a long time, so there's a whole rap in it. And I keep making it up, so it'll be interesting. So when I was about 12, my mother and father decided that I no longer was useful in the house because I was using all of her stash, and they kicked me out. So at 12, I was on the street in Brooklyn and have a big habit. I left the house with a large opium, heroin, alcohol habit. However, at 12, it was really cute, man. In Brooklyn, I knew of two drug dealers. Brooklyn used to be the largest city in New York, in America, the third largest city in America. And in that whole big place, there were two dope dealers, and they both thought I was really cute. And so I was able to stay loaded because I was such a cute little kid. I was very big for my age and had a lot of real alcoholic ways. I was able to talk my way in and out of a lot of things at 12 and stayed loaded on the street, living wherever I could, stealing whatever I could, doing whatever I could to keep my habit going. By the way, up until this point, I hadn't met anybody in my life who I thought wasn't loaded. When I was a little older, I wasn't cute anymore, and I really had to get money. And so I had to steal it. By the way, none of this stuff that I'm talking about I'm proud of. I don't want anybody to think that this is a heroic story. This is a terrible story about a kid that was doing terrible things for terrible reasons. I tell it because that's how it happened. But I don't consider a crook a hero in any way. And I was a crook, I hurt people, and I'm not happy about it. So I'll continue with the story. So my wife told me once when I said this part of my story that it looks like you're proud of it. Well, I'm not proud of it. Because the next part of my life was how I stole money every night. I would normally stand behind a truck with a large stick in my hand and wait till somebody passed who looked like they had money. And then I would run from behind the truck, grab them, and hit them with the stick until they stopped moving, and take their money and get loaded. And have enough money for that night and the next morning. And then I had to hustle for some more for that day. I did that for a long time. That combined with burglary and many, many other things that really I don't really want to talk about. They're just even more hideous than that. One day at... Now, Brooklyn is a lot like I see Vancouver. And it really does get dim in Brooklyn. A lot of times it's not sunny. And especially at 4 or 5 o'clock at night, it's gray out. And I was behind that truck, and a guy was walking down the street. I could picture him in my mind. He had this Al Capone hat on, that one that went like that, with the brim that went like that. And he had this camel colored coat, looked like it was cashmere. And it was long down to his ankles, and he had these wingtip shoes on, I knew this guy was rich. And so I thought maybe I could have enough to last me for 2 days if I took care of it properly. So I ran from behind the truck and hit this guy with a stick as hard as I could, and he didn't go down. And so I hit him again, and I hit him until he fell down, but he was still struggling. So I picked him and turned him over and was about to hit him again until I realized it was the cop on the beat dressed in civilian clothes. And I looked at him, and he looked at me, and I continued to hit him until he stopped moving. I took his money and forgot about it. Well, maybe a week or two later, I was on to my next horrible thing, and a cop car from the 73rd Precinct, New York, drove up on the sidewalk in front of me, and another one went behind me, and he took me off the street, and of course, you know, why would they arrest me? I had no idea why they would arrest me. I didn't do anything wrong. Not that day, anyway. And before I knew it, I was in a paddy wagon. Do you know what a paddy wagon is? I have some brothers and sisters here. And I was in this, a paddy wagon. In those days, nothing was as comfortable as it is these days. This was a truck that was a rough riding truck with a steel bench to sit on. And we just kept driving and riding and riding. And it seemed like hours and hours in this truck. And when we finally stopped and opened the door, I was right outside of what I would learn later was Sing Sing. Sing Sing is a prison in Ossining, New York. It's a place for murderers and all big-time crime guys. And what they did was there was a fellow who was arrested for murder, and they were taking him to Sing Sing. He escaped from the paddy wagon, and they didn't find him. In those days, there were no computers. They actually erased his name and description, put my name and description on, and I was in Sing Sing for murder. 14 years old in Sing Sing. This part of the story is difficult because the memory of the steel doors closing behind me was just an incredible experience. We walked through the big door in front that slid open, and I walked, by the way, I was manacled hand and foot all this time, so I had to be walking like this. It's not an easy task. I still didn't know what they were doing. You know, like, don't you know who I am? I haven't supposed to, you know, that kind of stuff. It's alcoholic bravado. When the gates slid closed behind me, I could hear them go, clack! And then we started to walk through the steel doors. We'd walk through a room or a big place. They'd open the door, and it was open with a clank and closed with a bang. And we went through a lot of doors. And finally, we entered into a room that seemed to be a very, very, very high steel room with tiers going up. And just imagine these guys, these murderers there, who could have been there for years and years, just men, looking at this cute little Jewish boy walking in. That feeling was horrifying. It was absolutely horrifying. And what those men did to me, was almost horrifying because I was only present for the first minute or so, and then I just went away. Woke up sometime later in another room with a roommate. It seems as if this roommate was the big shot, the big, inmate, the big shot inmate. He was the dope dealer of Sing Sing. So he had all the power there, and he won me. So I was his while I was there. And what was mine is all the dope I wanted, 24 hours a day. All the alcohol, all the, everything was clean. I just had to tune out every once in a while because this guy won me. That's all I can say about that, he won me.